This is a special presentation of the AD History Podcast.
Oh yeah, the music is going. We all know what that means now. That means this is the very beginning of our Patreon submitted question segment. And in this case, I don't think there could be a more appropriate question after the events of the last 3 weeks than the one we get today, because obviously, for those at the time of recording here, we have passed the official state of mourning that your nation has been in for the passing of the 96-year-old and 70-year-long reign of Elizabeth II. How is Queen Elizabeth II going to be remembered? And does she deserve the honorific title Elizabeth the Great or Elizabeth the Wise due to her time on the throne in regards to what a monarch's role should include in our modern day? Please go ahead.
So, you know, it's a big old sort of, there's a lot to unpack with this one. And we've actually kind of, normally me and you pause a peek behind the curtain. We kind of just talk about it. But this one, we've actually taken a lot of notes about it. I just want to kind of give you guys a chat so much about Queen Elizabeth II. So there's a lot to do with this one.
Yeah, because we recognize that a lot of our listeners, even though we have quite a few that are from the UK, the vast majority of them are not, and half of them are American. And a lot of Americans, you know, we know there's a queen. We know there's some form of symbolism. Well, there was a queen, I should say. There's a monarch.
There's a king
and
now.
That there's some, yeah, and there is some form of symbolism in their role, but it is a constitutional monarchy. And so we're going to get a little bit of an explainer in terms of, because to answer this question, you need to know exactly what some of the finer points are. And luckily, well, I should say we could not be more fortunate than to have a tax-paying Briton co-hosting this show.
An actual Briton. Who'd have thought? They exist. There's a whole island full of us, Paul. There's a whole island of just these strange British people.
About 65 million of you.
Around that, yeah. Like, there were... We're here. Luckily, you have got your hands on one. I can't promise I'm the best one to have your hands on in regards to this, but I'm going to do my best. I do.
You're the best one for AD history.
As a native Briton, the kind of things you just know about the royal family, which I guess you kind of take for granted, like there's kind of things I will say about the royal family, I've probably done in the past with this podcast. You kind of just presume everyone knows what you're talking about because it's so entrenched into British UK society. But of course, that isn't the case around the world, whether they be former Commonwealth countries, countries with strong ties to the UK, or countries that have nothing to do with the UK. Like, there's just things you kind of know and come to understand as a British person that you realize not everyone seems to know. So I'm happy to kind of lead this conversation in some way. And kind of bring the British perspective onto all of this. And something I want to talk about first is, I guess, kind of the crown itself. Because what I found so interesting for all of this is that no single person is beyond the crown. So the moment Elizabeth died, Charles became king, and it was straight away, boom, this is King Charles. And as much as that, and in regards to the mourning period, and yeah, we did have the mourning period for Elizabeth II, but the moment that was done, boom, she's out of there. The crown continues. It continues with Charles. So I find that really fascinating how that, like, looking forward has been just as pivotal during this time in the UK as looking back on the Queen's life.
It's in many ways, it's very much above temporal concerns.
It really is, yeah. It's just, it shows us how this thing, even though the majority of people, like anyone under the age of 70 has never known anything but Elizabeth as queen, it shows you that the crown is even beyond her, this sort of pillar of UK society. It's beyond her and it's going to move straight away, and that's just how it works. But I guess, like you said, Paul, one of the great things to talk about is what powers does a ruling monarch actually have? Well, it's kind of an all or nothing thing. In theory, they have an awful lot of power. But in reality, like in practicality, really, it's more or less, it's kind of none. And it's all to do with royal assent. So we won't go into too much detail about how laws and legislation are passed here in the UK, but the final kind of thing a law has to go through here in the UK is something called royal assent. And that's basically where a law, once it's been hashed out by the Houses of Parliament and the House of Lords and the Houses of Commons, it goes to the monarch. Obviously, for so long, that was Queen Elizabeth II. Now it's King Charles. It goes to royal assent, and the king or queen signs off of it, gives it the thumbs up. And once that happens, it's good to go. And in theory, any king or queen can say no to something from royal assent. They can. They can reject a law, say, no, I'm not going to sign off on that one.
And they haven't done that since the early 18th century, correct?
No, but I think it's like 1708, 1707 was the last time.
Yeah, the early 18th century.
Yeah, yeah. So it doesn't... In theory, the queen could have said no to any law. She could have... Not said no, she could have refused to sign any of those. She could have actually refused to have signed any of those, but she really can't, because it all comes back to, like, once again, the Glorious Revolution. This was in 1688, so the late 17th century. This is when King James II, I've been saying King Charles so much, King
yes, of course.
James II was replaced with his daughter Mary, who was daughter of the King of the Netherlands, Wilhelm of Orange, I believe.
William of Orange, yeah.
William of Orange, yeah. And that, in turn, that introduced a Bill of Rights here to the UK, which gave Parliament for the first time more power than the monarchy. And it's kind of, obviously, we've been on a trajectory since that moment for the real power in the UK to lie with Parliament as opposed to lying with the king or queen. And of course, everyone loves democracy, and democracy is a super important thing. And despite having a king, formerly queen, the UK is fundamentally democracy, starting with this moment. So if the queen were to have said no to any law made, chosen by her ministers, it would, of course, it would have been the end of democracy. It would have been a constitutional crisis. We wouldn't have been a democracy. We would have been an absolute monarchy, with one person having their say above anyone else's. So even though she could, in theory, say no to any of these and not given royal assent, that was never going to happen, and it probably won't happen in the future with King Charles III, with William when he's king. Unless something goes catastrophically wrong, that's not going to happen. But she does have other powers, of course, as we've talked about. It leaves her with something of a very ceremonial role. So all prime ministers have to go meet with her to formally request the former government in which the queen gave approval for. As we know, Liz Truss, one of the last things the queen did in power was give Liz Truss her approval to form a government. We all saw that famous picture of Liz Truss shaking hands with Elizabeth II.
And some of the things that are really interesting about that particular situation, when you stop and think about it, that only happened 2 or 3 days before she died, as I recall.
Yes.
And they had, obviously, they took pictures of it, because a lot of times they do that because the change of government, whatnot. And of course, it happened up in Balmoral in Scotland, which doesn't usually happen. That usually happens down in the office, down in Buckingham Palace. Mm-hmm. But it's amazing, because she was only 2 or 3 days away from dying, and yet the whole makeup of the whole thing really made it look like all is well, and she was very dedicated to making sure she fulfilled that role, despite the fact that, you know, she was going to die very soon thereafter, and everybody involved had to have known that. Think about the whole thing that had to be done to get her presentable and ready to do that.
I think it's so fascinating. Like, they needed to get one shot. Like, they literally needed to get one perfect shot of everything looking fine. Who on earth knows what happened before that shot and after that shot? Did Liz Truss know before she went up there? Like, it's so hard to say, but they had to make sure that one perfect shot was true. But even then, people noticed her hand. She had a really bruised hand where people had assessed that drips were in place. So
I imagine that Liz Truss had to have known, because it's pretty important that, obviously, the prime minister knows the health and well-being, both mind mm. and body of the monarch, and the monarch obviously needs to know the same thing about the PM. Mm.
Mm.
So, I mean, that had to be a hell of an affair. But do go on. You were talking about royal assent.
Yeah. So we're just talking about how like laws have to go past royal assent. And I can only imagine that once again, in theory, the queen could refuse to have given permission. I mean, she served under 15 PMs, I believe. I can't name them all.
So it's either 12 or 15.
Yeah.
Those are the two numbers.
I guess in theory, she could have refused any of them to form a government, but she never did. Once again, that would be a constitutional crisis. We couldn't have that happening.
Now, just as a point of just some information in terms of who she appoints as prime minister, as the British taxpayer in the audience, or rather not even the audience, as my co-host, take us through the process of who is chosen in that case.
Okay.
Who does she know to call to the palace?
Okay, so it's strange. When there's an election going on, you're not...
General election.
When there's a general election going on here in the UK, you're not technically voting for who is going to be prime minister. You're voting for your local MP. So in my case, my local MP is a guy called Luke Pollard. He's a Labour MP. In my case, I'm voting for him, or like the Tory MP or the Green Party MP. I'm voting for a local MP or no... On my ballot slip, unless I'm living in the same constituency where the MP who's going to become prime minister is, like the name Boris Johnson or Keir Starmer doesn't appear anywhere on my ballot slip when I go to vote because it just doesn't. So whoever wins the vote in my local area, their party gets the seat. So it's Labour or Conservative or Lib Dem or Green or whatever you wanted it to be. And then the party who gets the most seats in Commons, their leader becomes the prime minister. They're literally the minister who is prime. They're the prime minister. That's where that name comes from. So what you're really... So the person who becomes prime minister is the leader of that party. But the leader of the party is also just a normal MP. So Liz Truss currently, as well as being the head of the UK government, she is actually a regular MP as well. It's kind of a weird thing. There's some interesting articles out there explaining what your life is like when your local MP is also the PM.
I wondered that myself.
Yeah, it's a strange thing. I've never experienced it myself. So I don't know where Liz Truss is. I don't know what constituency Liz Truss has. I think Johnson was Brunel or somewhere in London. So he is still technically
in Uxbridge?
Uxbridge, yes. Uxbridge, not Brunel. Mixed up.
The head.
You know that one. Even though Johnson is no longer prime minister, he is still a member of parliament for Uxbridge. So his primary focus now will be supporting the people in his constituency. I mean, his primary support is trying to figure out how to get back in, but we don't need to talk about that. So, yeah, we don't need to talk about that. So,
of course.
So that explains why Liz Truss, despite no one actually voted for Liz Truss, except for the Conservative Party. That's how she has become the new prime minister, because Johnson stepped down as head of the Conservative Party, in turn, no longer prime minister. So the Conservative Party had to vote for a new leader who would also ergo become prime minister. So it was only Conservative Party members, who I believe about 100,000 or so, 120,000, they're the ones who actually voted for Liz Truss.
So when you're casting a ballot in a true general election, you're casting the ballot for the local MP, their party, party leader, and effectively the stated platform of the party that they are a part of.
Exactly, yeah.
So it's basically a 4-in-1 vote.
Yeah, basically. So use it wisely and go and vote. That's what I would say.
Very different than the American system.
So that's something we'll definitely... Maybe next, 2 years' time, Paul, we'll talk about that, because I'd love to know more about how the actual voting works over in the state side.
It's a hell of a process.
When it's a tad more topical in about 2 years' time, 24, we'll definitely talk about that.
Yeah, sure. I always love giving civics lessons.
Yeah. So one thing that's also interesting, I believe, there's a term for it. I can't remember what the term is. You can be the leader of your party, but not have a seat in parliament. So for example, a few years back, UKIP were a huge, huge, huge deal. The UK Independence Party, they wanted out of the EU. You saying
that was headed by Nigel Farage?
Yes, headed by Nigel Farage.
But he didn't have a seat.
He didn't have. He was never an MP. I think he might have been an MEP, but he was never an actual MP. Yeah,
he was.
So you can, and I think in theory during the 2019 election, Lord Buckethead, who's like this joke political character here in the UK.
He's one of the best.
If you know, you know. I believe he ran in the same constituency as Johnson did. So if he won it, if Lord Buckethead became MP where Johnson was running, Johnson wouldn't be, he wouldn't be a member of parliament. But if the Tories still got a majority, he would have still been their leader. So he would have been a prime minister, but not a member of parliament. Which is,
I think he was running in the same constituency as Theresa May was. This is back in like 2016,
2017,
or 2017 when she called that snap election.
Yeah, yeah.
That was a hell of a thing to watch, having him out there, and she had to play very, very nice with him, despite the fact that he's obviously a sham candidate. Yeah, he's a celebrity unto himself.
Not a sham at all, Paul. How dare you?
Well, you get the idea. He was not trying to truly get elected. Though, if he had, good God help us, that would have been something. Mm. If one of those kind of candidates, because the UK has this political culture that is. It's serious. It's a blood sport. But here in the United States, obviously, we don't have that same kind of approach where there can be some almost institutionalized, approved silliness in the process, in the same way is also kind of self-deprecating.
It's a very silly country here, Paul. And like, even the fact that your party, your country is so two-party, for the longest time, it felt the UK was... In my lifetime, it feels like that's changed a lot here in the UK. When I was younger, it was mainly Labour and Conservative, but the Lib Dems have really ebbed and flowed. They had their 2010 backstabbing with Nick Clegg joining the coalition, but they're on the rise again now, Lib Dems, which is really fascinating. They're definitely worth looking out for again, despite...
They were also part of a coalition government starting in 2010, as I recall.
Yes, that's what I was saying. So they... That was a big controversial thing because they joined arms with the Conservatives and just did all kinds of things that were against the fundamental idea of the Lib Dems. So that really hampered. A lot of people voted for the Lib Dems in that election because they didn't want the Tories. It still ended up with the Tories. So that hurt the Lib Dems. And I think following the 2015 election, they got like no seats. But since then, since the 2017 and 2019 elections, they've been building up momentum again. People are starting to forgive the Lib Dems once again.
But going back to the ruling monarch.
Yes, of course. Yeah. Going back to old Liz.
She also has she had, and now King Charles, of course, has it now. He also has the three powers that are formally granted to him.
Yeah. So there is still some degree of power. A lot of this has to do with the weekly meetings the monarch has with the prime minister. So this is a long-standing tradition. As prime minister, you get a weekly meeting with, obviously, the queen then, the king now. It's the importance of his ebbed and flowed. Paul, you were telling me that Queen Victoria, you did your own little research here, Queen Victoria didn't care too much for these meetings.
Well, from what I understand is that she really made sure that it was kind of an in-and-out process. So it was one of those things where, if I understand correctly, you know, it'd be about 20 minutes long, and it wasn't, and they basically, you know, she was using kind of almost, this is going to sound terrible, but kind of almost like a lapdog thing. Not that they were in any way truly beholden to her, but basically when you got called in, you knew what you had to say, get it off quickly, no tea, you know, no... You know, sitting around on the couch and chatting, you know, it was very much business, as I understand it.
Yeah, so that's really interesting to hear. So the actual ongoings of these meetings are very private, so we'd actually know. One of the things I remember about them recently is I think the week before the UK had its first lockdown, Johnson was still insistent on going to these meetings face-to-face.
It didn't have, there was obviously they use Zoom during but usually they're supposed to be face to face. But, you know, in the modern world where you can have the head of government, the PM, you know, somewhere on the other side of the planet, I have to imagine that's taken into consideration. Yeah. I can't be sure of that, but I think that is the case.
I think Dominic Cummings was like, no, you cannot do that face-to-face. Like, there's this thing going around. He was like, no, I'm going to do it. So that's quite fascinating as well. Like, they're a historic thing. But when it comes to these meetings, the monarch kind of has sort of free, soft powers. So, like, they can't outright
say things. Not to be confused with the concept of soft power.
No. So they kind of influence things. So these three things the monarch can do is to caution, encourage, and warn. So
that's interesting.
It is, isn't it? So if the prime minister comes in and says, hey, I'm thinking of, nationalizing the railway system for whatever, just a random thing. If the current monarch is in favor of that, they could encourage it. Oh, that's a great idea. They could caution it, saying, have you thought this all through? Or they could even warn against it. They can't say, no, don't do that. They could warn, like, oh, it might not be the best idea. So it's a real influence.
It definitely is, because you look at caution, encourage, and warn. There's so many ways you could potentially interpret that.
Totally.
And that's how I look at it. It's like, I wonder, because since they're private meetings, we'll never truly know, at least not for a very long time, to what extent any of those three were occurring over the time of her as monarch. I'd be very curious to see how she exercised those.
These are words that don't really imply you have to obey them. Is someone to caution you, Paul, about something? Has there ever been a time you've been cautioned about something and not listened to their caution?
Oh, of course.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm sure that's same with you and anybody. You know, really, it's just...
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, you might not want to do that is very different than you will not do
that. Yeah. So even though these things are in place, the prime minister doesn't have to actually pay any attention to them at all. Like, you can caution someone all you want, or you can encourage someone, or you can warn someone, but you don't actually have to listen to it. These aren't King Charles or formerly Queen Elizabeth going, no, you can't do that. I wouldn't advise you from doing that. So it's interesting. It's something of a reversal of that sort of historical idea we have of a monarchy. Like we see in things like Game of Thrones, where they have the Privy Council and they're advising the king, but it's ultimately the king who gets the final decision.
A royal autocracy.
It's kind of the flip side of that, where it's the king, formerly queen, trying to advise, and it fundamentally comes down to the PM if they choose to do it or not.
Yeah, it sounds kind of like the way this is at least supposed to work out by design is that the monarch acts as like a safety bumper. Like,
yeah.
Okay, like you don't want to get too far off the rails here. You know, obviously you're going to do what you're going to do, but I'd be very careful because of X, Y, and Z. And I have to imagine that in order to serve that well, any one of those three, you have to be somewhat in touch with the nation.
Totally. And that's a whole debate unto itself, how in touch with the nation
the royal family
are. That's a very big question to understand how much they truly understand the working class people of this country.
And that's actually where the first question I'm going to ask you about Elizabeth is, because you're on the ground and she's, other than very recently, she's all you've known. To what extent do you personally and just in general feel that she's had a good pulse on the mood and feeling of the nation?
I think it's a super hard question to ask that, because despite how universal she is seen, there's probably genuinely not a day has gone past here where, if you're in the UK, it's probably not a day has gone past where I haven't seen her face, because she's on the money, she's on the stamps. You can't really avoid her. So despite how universally well known of she is, she's actually something of an enigma. It's part of being king or queen. Charles has outright said now he's king, he can't be as expressive on political beliefs. He's for so long been such a champion of nature and global warming. Now he's, like I said, because I'm king now, I can't really talk about that. But while that might sound like she hasn't really had her finger on the pulse, it's kind of allowed people because she's never really expressed a political opinion during her entire reign as queen, it's kind of allowed people to paint her in any picture they want. Everyone has seen Queen Elizabeth II in a way that suits them best. You mentioned off camera, Paul. It's one of the greatest parasocial relationships in history.
Yeah, because you can see her in and paint her in whatever brush
however
as broadly
you want.
As you
yeah.
want. So she can, and I think that's actually really fascinating that she was able to achieve that, because you think she came into power when she was basically in her early to mid-20s.
Mm.
And there are plenty of people that at that age that have very, very strongly held political opinions.
Mm.
And her son now is coming in at the age of 73, who has very well documented opinions. He's written an entire book. Yeah, Harmony back in 2010. And that was never the case for her because she came in so young.
Mm.
And I have always been curious to know what her actual thoughts were, but we'll probably never know, or at least not know it for a very long time. You know, this kind of brings us to the next question, which is, we know that when it comes to the monarch of the UK, they are a symbol of the nation.
Mm.
And something I heard recently that is truly spot on, that when it comes to soft power, like formal soft power, not just culture that comes out of Britain, but in some cases that can be from this, that Britain has two of the greatest forms of soft power in the world. One is the BBC, and especially the BBC World Service, and a lot of the programs they come up with, it'd be like Sherlock. Is Downton Abbey a BBC production?
No, Downton Abbey is ITV,
ITV, okay.
Yeah. But like, ITV does have, it's not a fully independent company, I believe. I think there is some.
Well, for the long time, they also did Doctor Who.
Doctor Who's still a thing.
I would say so.
Yeah.
So that's one thing that Britain has. And the other, of course, is the crown, because you may not understand how the politics and governance in Westminster occurs, but even if you are not that politically active or interested, you could still point out, okay, that's the queen or that's the king.
Mm.
And there are still other ruling houses on the European continent, but they're very, I would say, if I were to call it anything, kind of a watered down version of so much of the pomp and circumstance that comes with the House of Windsor and the ruling British monarch.
I think I did a video a while back for Queen Elizabeth's Diamond Jubilee. And I said in that video, if you just say the Queen, people will know that you were talking about Elizabeth II.
Absolutely.
There are tons of other queens. I think the longest running queen in the world now is Denmark's Margaret or Matilda.
That may be true.
Yeah. So like now, I guess she's de facto the queen. But for the longest time, you could have just said the queen and everyone. I'm sure probably even people in countries with queens like Spain or Denmark or the Netherlands, if you just say the queen, they probably knew you were talking about Elizabeth. She had that much influence. She was the de facto queen.
So much gravitas.
Yeah,
there.
And it's something a lot of European countries have let go of for various reasons due to revolution, obviously with France. It's just something they have decided to not as part of their cultural identity, I suppose. But the UK, it's so synonymous with royalty. Some could argue that by this point they've come sort of a part of tourism, like they become a brand. I think I read somewhere that like
absolutely they are a brand.
The royal family brand is one of the most prestigious brands in the UK. And there's another interesting
article.
And the world. As an article, I was reading, this is quite an off tangent. An article reading like, was Elizabeth II bigger than the royal family? And the only thing I can kind of compare it to is something like Marvel, when they've just reached this place where like they've gotten rid of Roy Downey Jr. as Iron Man, they've gotten rid of Chris Evans as Captain America, and they're kind of interested, hey, these new superheroes. And it's kind of like, will people still be interested in this product? Doctor Who's the best example. Will people still care for this big product without the same face behind it? And that's kind of a question people are arguing about the royal family is, are they going to drive in that level of tourism without Elizabeth?
Now, my next question to you
is... It's a random subject, but interesting. So carry on.
We're talking about how in touch she was with the nation. During your time alive, through her role and conscious decisions that she made in terms of things that she decided to do publicly, what were in, do you remember as being some of the most positive things that she did during your lifetime that you thought, hey, this, you know, this is the monarchy working the way it, it, the modern conception of it wants it to work, where she's doing something positive?
One of the great things she did, Paul, was during the opening ceremonies of the 2012 London Olympics. I'm sure you know all about this, Paul. She flew in with James Bond. Like, she literally parachuted in a skydive with
Daniel Craig.
Yeah. It's just silly things like that. Even recently, during her Silver Jubilee, she did the little sketch with Patton Silver. During her Platinum Jubilee, she did the little sketch with Paddington Bear.
Which that was actually pretty adorable.
Yeah, she was just very good. Like I said, I don't know if it was her doing those sort of things, if that was her own choice, or people telling her, hey, it'd be great if you did this. I don't know, but she was constantly in the public eye, doing always happy to do something like that. And that just really resonates with you. Being sort of silly, it's that kind of whole British self-deprecation sort of thing. No one's above being silly here in the UK. And the Queen reminded us all through doing bits like that. So when I remember great things she did, stuff like that comes to mind. Even the fact, I believe one time, maybe in the early 2010s, I want to say 2012, 2013 or so, someone on a whim invited her to their wedding. And she turned up. She turned
That's
up.
Incredible.
Yeah.
That's so cool. I wonder who it was.
She was very good at making like back page news, for lack of a better. Like just sort of silly, very good at doing sort of just silly little harmless things, just being there in the background. And that's the thing. She was just, she wasn't eternally at the forefront of everything in British life. She's just a very nice character. Someone you could always depend on being there in the background. Of course, there is more sort of legislative sort of stuff she did in the past as well. I was a child when Diana died, so I know her response to that was quite infamous. I don't remember it myself, but
I remember that. I was old enough to remember that. Yeah, because it was just huge world news.
Yeah, and I was 97, wasn't it? I would have been three at the best, I think. So yeah, I don't particularly remember that. But it kind of shows, like, just she was always just a presence in things. And when I think of great things she's done, that's the kind of thing that comes to mind for me. What can I say?
Well, I think those are the important things. I mean, you look at, say, the example of the death of Princess Diana, which was obviously a horrific, horrific accident in terms of a way to go. And I believe Tony Blair was doing an interview recently that I saw him. And apparently, there's a lot of people that seem to believe that he was the one who encouraged her to actually make a public statement about that, which is a public statement I think most people are probably familiar with. It's most likely gotten replayed a great many times in the last 3 weeks. And when he was asked about it, saying, you know, were you actually the one who encouraged her? And he said, yes and no. She already had it in her head that she needed to do something. And that, you know, both a combination of her and the people around her kind of had it already rather clear in their mind that they needed to do something. Because even though Diana was no longer a part of the royal family because she and Charles had gotten divorced, she still was this hugely international celebrity. And also, on top of that, the mother of the future, presumably future King of England in William. So in that, she does seem like she had a decent idea of what was expected of her and hitting the right note. And if you listen to this podcast, which clearly you do because you're in this conversation right now listening, you'll also know at the end of our trailer, she is also in it as well.
Of course, Shatsby.
Yeah, where in this case, it was her speech regarding COVID-19. And I believe we included the bit, as I believe it goes something like, and we will succeed, and that success will belong to every one of us. Which bring me kind of another interesting point, and this is something of an evolution of the role that started before her.
Mm.
And the question is going to be to you, to what extent do you feel that she has fulfilled it? And not just her, but the working royals in particular. The dynamic of the monarchy and the nation has changed, at least most fundamentally, going from the nation working for their monarch because they're the ones in charge, to the monarchy having to work for the nation.
Your obedient servant.
More or less.
Yeah.
And to what extent do you feel that evolution has occurred in what you've seen in your lifetime?
It's strange, you know, because I guess in the grand scheme of the Queen's reign, while it was my entirety, it was what? Like, 27, was 27 take away 70? It was less than half, maybe a quarter, maybe just over a quarter or a third or so of her entire reign. So I kind of saw in the grand scheme the twilight days of her monarchy. To me, the Queen was always just a little old lady who, yes, while extremely powerful, you never really saw her exert that power in any particular way. Saying even the death of Diana, I was too young to remember that. I don't really recall any major moments when she made big changes. I was saying one thing I do remember, one big change I do remember with the monarchy was with the birth of Prince George.
Yes.
George's William's and Kate's eldest son. He's second in line to the throne now. So he's just behind his dad and that Charles. His granddad is now king. He's second in line. Just prior to his birth, a change was made in the law. And traditionally, it was the eldest born son of the monarch who would become king. So even if Will and Kate had three daughters and then a son, that son, their fourthborn, would have become king over them. So this law was changed. That was any firstborn, regardless of sex or gender, would become king.
And that's a
king.
Big change.
It's a humongous change. You know, that was, what, 2012, I believe? Maybe a bit earlier, 2011? Humongous change. And it's shocking it took that long. But I think one of the reasons it took that long is because it took... because there really wasn't need to, that law was clearly introduced so when they had this child, it could be celebrated as the next king or queen of the country. We hadn't had that moment in a very long time. The last time we'd had that moment was when Will was born. And when was Will born? Early 80s, late 70s, potentially?
Early 80s, I think.
Early
yeah.
80s. Will would have been born. And back then, like even then, the time wasn't ready, clearly. It took about another 20, 30 years for that to happen, for us, for the nation, for the royal family to be open-minded enough to think that change could happen. So yeah, that's why it took quite a long time to change, but it's a humongous change. And it'll really come into effect years and years and years from now when George has his own children. If George were to have a daughter first, she would be next in line to the throne, despite the fact she's a woman. And that's great. That's a big change to our monarchy that happened during my lifetime. And I'm fully on board with that.
And a lot of my observations have been very much a product of listening to folks who actually live in the country.
Mm.
And a couple of them that I think are kind of interesting. One is that even though she did a lot of it, she was not what one would call a gifted public speaker. You know, she always had the written text, glasses on, looking down. And, you know, she would make changes, as I understand it, to make it fully tailored to her. But she never really deviated from it. I mean, it wasn't like what her dad had to deal with where he had a legitimate speech impediment or something like that. But she always was very on text. You know, there wasn't any big deviation from that. In addition to that, she wasn't somebody who, you know, had an advanced degree from Oxford or Cambridge.
No.
And both of these things are interesting for a couple of reasons. And I can't even begin to take credit for this because I was not the one who came up with it, but they rang to me as very interesting. And it actually comes from a video that was recently released by an education or edutainment, as it were, creator on YouTube that you may be familiar with. He's been doing it for a long time now. His name is Lindy Beige.
Name rings a bell.
Lindy Beige does a lot of stuff, especially with military history. And most of it, not all of it, but a lot of it is just him in front of a camera for about an hour talking. And he's just very, very engaging. And he made two interesting points. He said, with the public speaking, in many ways, the fact that she wasn't like a truly gifted on the stump speaker, the fact that she wasn't meant that she would stay on text and it would help her stay away from gaffes. Because if you're a good public speaker and you crack a good joke, there's always going to be that part of you that says, oh, well, you know, if I got that joke, you know, maybe I can insert this one. And that's when you can start running into trouble. And of course, she didn't do that. The other thing is, in terms of education, there was an interesting observation that he made, which is that the public in general is a little skeptical of intellectuals. And that she was somebody that always seemed to emanate this very good practical common sense that most anybody could get on board with, which is to say, you know, that, you know, she is not some big intellectual figure, but she's somebody that if you sat down, you had a conversation with her in your own kitchen, you would find that, okay, this is somebody that I can trust because I know that they have good practical sense. And I'm curious what your thoughts are on those points.
I think they're very valid things to have, and I do agree with them to an extent. In her passing, there's been so many stories from ordinary people. Of course, she met with plenty of just normal members of the public.
That's an interesting point I want to talk about in a bit.
Yeah, and she was like, the amount of them who have come out and said, like, no matter who you were, if you talked to her, it kind of like felt like she was talking to you directly. She clearly had amazing, well, not great into like writing or speech skills. She clearly had amazing people skills.
Yes.
Like she knew how to engage people from all the evidence we have out there of how she talked with other people when meeting them. Because I think I read a stat there. She's probably the person who's met the most people. Like she's probably met more people than anyone else on our planet. I'm not saying walking across the street, literally meet, hello, this is them. She probably would have met an astronomical amount of people. So she needed it. She needed to have this great kind of floating around. Oh, hi there, nice to meet you. Yeah, from what I can gather, she had incredible people skills. And being warm and kind and being able to generally talk to someone and listen to someone is such a talent. It's a talent you can learn. It's a skill you can learn from like doing counseling, sort of qualifications, therapy. They teach you how to actually listen to someone. I'm not saying the Queen had those qualifications, but she clearly had a great knack of being warm and open and kind with everyone she met. So while she wasn't a charismatic, bombastic speaker like your Churchills, she clearly had a way with people as opposed to a way with words. And that's clearly helped capture her image so much as this warm, kind person.
And something that I find truly fascinating is that when you're talking about her and all the people that she met, I think somebody came out that over the span of her lifetime, somewhere like maybe 10 to 15% of all Britons at some point made her acquaintance personally.
Wow.
That's incredible.
That's a huge number. I'm not one of them, in case you're wondering. I'm not one of them. But it's an unfathomably huge number of people to meet.
Now, let's think about the existence, though, of a monarch in her case. And think about how unbelievably unrelatable that is simply to the human condition, where you're not allowed to publicly state a position, where you and I live in countries that value and champion free speech. And all of us have that right to do so. But in her case, she couldn't do that. On top of that, she also had to be very careful about various lines that she walked and various people that you know, you have to imagine there were plenty of people that she couldn't meet for a variety of reasons, because for one reason or another, you may not want to be associated with them, and how you've lived in this fishbowl for so many years, unable to express, you know, various opinions out there publicly. You're involved in political life. You have the ear of the power brokers in London, but you don't truly have the practical power of being able to say yes and no to a bill or become involved in this way or another. Can you imagine what that must be like, on top of the fact that she never seemed to deviate from what she considered her duty as monarch for 7 decades? I mean, that's almost twice as long as either you or I have been alive.
Yeah.
And obviously they're never going to be curious, whether if you're a member of the royal family, the monarch, you're never going to have to question where your daily bread's going to come from.
No.
But at the same time, can you envy that existence? And for me, it's just so hard to believe that you could. There's something that I think we all take for granted in anonymity and being able to go the places we want to go and do the things we want to do and say the things that we think.
Oh, yeah.
Without the paparazzi in your face or the papers on your rear end.
It's so easy to be like, oh, I hate the monarchy. The monarchy could go. And on face value, there's so much. You can understand it. I won't share my own opinions on the matter here, but like, it's understandable why many people think the monarchy should be abolished here in the UK, here in other countries, wherever. It is strange that there's this one that you can live a life of luxury, a life of ease, of wealth, solely due to the family you were born in. And I'm not just talking about the main working royals, like your princes. I'm talking about like your dukes and earls. Like you know, there's a current Duke of Norfolk, Paul. I couldn't tell you who he is. I couldn't tell you his name. Couldn't tell you what he looked like. And I'm sure most British people couldn't do that. But he gets to live a life of extreme luxury and wealth, and also have the anonymity of a normal British person, like,
and gives nothing back to the nation.
Gives nothing back to the nation, exactly. So their existence is very different to those main working royals, who, you know, Queen Elizabeth has had pretty much her entire life on camera until I think she turned 26, just 26, 27 when she became queen.
Something like that.
Up and beyond that moment, she wasn't allowed to publicly share any of her political beliefs, only her private beliefs. She wasn't a private person. It takes a lot to give up your privacy. So,
oh, goodness, yes.
Yeah, there is a massive send-off if you do want to live that life. And it's not anything I've envious of. I'd rather be who I am now than King of England. Like, I don't want that. And something else I find interesting about this is the whole tax situation with the royal family.
Yeah, the financial side of things is very interesting.
It's really fascinating. I kind of did a little bit of a dive into it before we started recording, because it's so... The common narrative is that we pay taxes and the royal family don't, and we pay for their luxurious lifestyle. Kind of true, kind of not true. So how the royal family get their earnings is through something called a sovereign grant. Each year, the royal family as a whole are given a grant, and that grant is paid for them by the government. And that grant is consists of 25% of all the profits made from the Crown Estate revenue. The Crown Estate is basically all the land owned by the Crown and the money it generates. So say in 1 year it makes £100 million. It makes a lot more than that, but say in 1 year it makes £100 million. That entire £100 million gets given to the government, to the Treasury, and then the government in turn gives 25% of that. So in this example, £25 million back to the royal family. That's their sovereign grant. That's what they're allowed to have. Obviously the Queen has her own private wealth as well. We don't need to talk about that. That's a whole nother subject. So no, the royals don't pay tax in that traditional sense. But that's because they get all the money. The government give them all their money and then give them a small percentage of it back. So they kind of do and don't pay tax. And even beyond that, royals pay tax in like many other ways. So like one of the big differences between our country's pool is you guys don't have tax on prices when you go to buy something.
That's, well, from the, there's no federal state.
State by state, yeah.
It's all state by state. So like here where I am, there's definitely sales tax.
Okay.
But not, there's no, as far as I know, there's no federal sales tax.
Okay. So things like sales tax, here in the UK, everything has sales tax. When you look at the price, it has sales tax attached to it.
It's basically a VAT for those that are not familiar.
Exactly. It's not like, say if the Queen wants to buy a can of Coke, it's not, as normally sold for £1 with tax on. It's not like she goes to buy it and they take the VAT off, she has to pay 80p or something like that. She'll still pay tax on things like that. They still pay tax on property. And even beyond that, both the Queen and Charles volunteered to pay income tax and capital gains tax. I believe in like the 1990s, 1980s, they actually agreed to voluntarily pay tax to be okay. So like to be on the government. So that whole debate, oh, they don't pay taxes, it's
true
kind of,
and it isn't.
It's true and it isn't true. There's a lot more to it than a blanket. They don't pay tax and they live their luxurious lifestyle solely off of our taxpayer money.
Now, something that is interesting here, because this is something that, as far as I know, that the government has championed for a long time. And if it is as such, it definitely serves as one of the reasons practically why the institution will continue, which is that I think it was in 2017, the money that was allotted to the royal family, which, as I understand correctly, a lot of it has to do with the cost regarding their personal security, which can run upwards of £100 million a year, which is, you know, no small amount of money to be sure.
No. Yeah.
And, you know, if you bring that out to what, there's roughly 65 million Britons nowadays.
About that, yeah. About 65 million.
So, you know, you're talking about, what, a little bit more than a pound per Briton in that case. And we're talking about the soft power and attracting things like tourism and the royal brand, and that the money that takes in exceeds the amount that's actually spent on them, both towards the actual government purse and that which is distributed throughout the UK economy due to things like tourism and merchandise, because that is, the crown has merch, no doubt.
Oh, yeah.
And that it exceeds that. And I imagine if it is true as stated, that will be something that will definitely help the monarchy endure because, you know, they're keeping the coffers full.
Yeah.
Which I do think is interesting. So now it really comes to the question.
Yeah, let's get the actual question.
As a Briton who is neck deep in the study of history, especially the history of their own country, which, as we've mentioned many times on this show, most people are most interested in the history of their own country, which is totally understandable, even though you and I have historical interests that go well beyond our respective shores. Based on what a monarch is expected to be in the UK in modernity, you know, we call Catherine the Great a great for very different reasons, because it's relative to the time and system that she was in charge. And of course, she was an autocrat, you know.
No.
There's no question that Tsarina gets last called in that case. But the criteria is very different when you're talking about somebody like Elizabeth II in terms of either calling her the great historical calling wise, because this is an honorific title. It's an honorific title and it'll take on its own life if there's merit to it, I think. Could you call her and either of those two as a Briton? I'll give my opinion as an American, but you go first because it's your country.
So I think something's going to happen. If memory serves, Johnson from the backbenches, because obviously he stopped being prime minister a couple of days before
he died.
Yeah,
he's on the backbenches now.
I think he would have desperately wanted to have reigned over this funeral. But from the backbenches, that's a different conversation. He declared her Elizabeth the Great. So clearly he's already...
Oh, he did.
He's clearly trying to be the one... to get that. Oh, that was me. I did that. So
yeah,
There's already...
and he has his own historical pretenses as well as a historical,
exactly.
Of course.
He's got his own agenda, his own historical pretenses, definitely. So there is definitely things happening in that regard. Time will tell if that will happen. As you were saying, the reason people like Alexandra, Catherine was dubbed the Great was because of very different reasons why someone would be great now. And a great example is of Alexander the Great. He was dubbed the Great because of all the amazing battles he won. He was the head of his own military's army, and so often these titles...
And fought with them.
And fought amongst them. And of course, while the modern royal family have served in the army, Elizabeth was a jeep driver during the Second World War. Charles, I think, has done naval service. Philip did naval. They're not in the midst of it. Like,
yeah, Phil the Greek was out on the Battle of the Atlantic.
Exactly. That's why a lot of these ancient historical figures have these titles. But it's hard to know if Elizabeth was great, because for so long, it's all we've known. She is going to be the measuring stick. She is the only 21st century queen the UK has had. And she was pretty much the only queen, the only monarch the 20th century has had. Granted, she came into what, power 52, so half of the century had already passed, but a lot of that half was taken up by a thing called World War One and World War Two. So it was hard to actually do anything about it, really. And that was the only thing. Being a king, or being the kings who were kings during the war, was a whole thing unto themselves. They've got their own legacy. But for peacetime Britain, she's literally all we've known as a monarch. She's going to be the measuring stick. All future monarchs for the 21st century, for the 22nd century potentially, are going to be measured by. And there's probably, unless Charles abdicates or something unfortunately tragic happens, we're not ever going to have another reign like that. Just... the numbers aren't in anyone's favour. By the time Will gets on the throne, he'll probably be in his 60s, 70s himself.
Maybe.
So yeah, I think there is a valid reason to call her great or wise, or maybe something different. Like, I think something like Elizabeth the Eternal, because like she just reigned for so long. A title
that's interesting. That's clever. I like that.
Like,
that's clever.
Something
I like that
highlights her length as queen, something that comments on the duration of her monarchy rather than the quality of it, and kind of gives her this status as she will always be, because she will always be the queen. In mine and your lifetime, Paul, we're probably not going to see another queen of the UK.
That's very unlikely.
In our lifetimes.
Only if something really happens to George.
Exactly. If something happens to George, we're not going to see that happen anytime soon. Probably not. So I think she's going to be remembered as, I could easily see her becoming something like the Great or the Wise or a different title anywhere else. But like I was saying, we just don't know anything better, because she reigned for the majority of the 20th century, for all of the 21st century. We don't know another queen or monarch like it to compare her to dub her to being fully great. But I wouldn't be surprised if it happens. But what are your thoughts on the matter then? As a non-Brit...
So the first thing I'll say is, in terms of the longevity of her rule, the only other monarch that we can really look at in that regard is Victoria. And as far as I know, I've never heard anybody apply the Great to Victoria, though she's had such a profound impact on the entire world, especially in terms of culture.
Mm.
And the fact that we had an entire, you know, Victorian era.
And
we're not even thinking about her. We're thinking about an era.
The amount of things I walk past called Victoria have Victoria in their title.
Or Albert.
You forget the names after that Victoria.
Yeah. And just, obviously after Albert died, she was naming everything Albert.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I remember one author of a biography I've read of her, which was particularly good, said that after he died, she mourned very, very loudly for decades. And things like the Royal Albert Hall are a part of that.
Mm.
So we don't call Victoria the Great, though in some ways I think you probably reasonably could, depending on how you look at it. But in this case, I do think longevity is important. Something that I do think very much weighs in favor of her receiving such an honorific title, which is always unofficial, really, but it's still meaningful, or else we wouldn't be talking about it, is the fact that she's going to be the measuring stick.
Yeah.
She's going to be the measuring stick. Yeah. So it's measuring stick. So I do think that is important. And in addition to that, though it may not be in politics, in Britain, I don't ever remember anybody ever truly criticizing her.
No, not someone of power. There's always been criticism of the Queen. You can go on Twitter and see criticism of the Queen.
Yeah, that's all over the place. Yeah,
someone in power, whether that be the party in power or the opposition. No, I think it would have been career suicide.
Like, exactly. I mean, and that speaks to, I think, some of the general popularity and esteem that she's held in, or was held in, to be sure. So the fact that she's going to be the measuring stick is important. And on top of the fact that she did a lot of things reform-wise that were important, but quiet. As I recall, and, you know, don't take me to court on this, but I'm fairly sure, I think it was under Harold Wilson, she gifted Westminster Palace to the nation. That's a big deal, because those who may not be familiar with this, things like Buckingham Palace, Balmoral, Westminster, whatever the case may be, those actually belong to the Windsors. And prior to that, Westminster Palace was and did belong to the royal family. I believe the last time a monarch actually ruled from there was back in the medieval period. But the idea was that, hey, constitutionally, even though I know the British don't have a formal constitution like the United States has, it's a series of precedents, as it were, and conventions that have kind of built up over time that guide how the government and how power is exercised in your country. Basically, the idea was that in theory, certainly from a constitutional basis, the whole idea that she would ultimately could be in a position where she doesn't like something that Parliament is doing, but she owns the building so she could throw them out, was not something that could stand.
No.
And she tended to do these things more quietly. And I think that is very interesting, and I think it speaks to her judgment. I think if there's anything that you can say about her is that she had very good judgment. And to that end, while the concept of Elizabeth the Great could very well be fitting, I think maybe, just maybe, depending on how things go from here, and it's not going to be for you or I to judge because we'll have no ability to do it. This is something that will take on a life of its own over a long period of time. And will be for students of history that are our successors. That perhaps the most fitting of all of those possibilities is Elizabeth the Wise. Because she did seem like she had a good pulse on the nation. She did seem like she had a genuine modesty and had an understanding that if this institution is to endure and benefit the British public primarily, it would need to change. And from what I understand, it obviously has changed. It's changed a lot just in the last century, even before she came about. So if I were to call her anything, and we will see in the long term, because wisdom usually bears out its fruit in the long term. If I were to be the final arbiter of this, I would probably consider her calling her Elizabeth the Wise, because it speaks much more to what was special about her, is that she had a certain practical wisdom that was undeniably beneficial, and that she walks away from all of this and people say, you know, hey, you know, as monarchs go, you're a pretty darn good one.
And I think wise fits the bill better. Like we're saying, great so often has like military or physical power behind it, like military might, and that wasn't the empire, that wasn't the kingdom she reigned. She was a wise. I think just from that sort of perspective, wise is a lot more sensible.
And clearly, we will see how well that wisdom bears out in terms of how well Charles was prepared for the role as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, there has been some very well-noted scandals regarding certain other children that I don't think we need to mention, which I don't think is a particularly wonderful mark on the record. But even so, nobody blames her.
No, no.
Well, in any case, Patrick, I think this was a good conversation.
It was a great conversation.
Especially for those of us that are not Bretons.
No, and yes. Thank you very much for letting me sort of chat about this. I've been doing so...
Well, thank you for chatting about this.
I've done so much royal family stuff recently, especially everyone named Expert. I did like a whole week of royal content. I'm looking forward to not looking at the royal family any longer, though. Give a little break from talking about them, I think, for a moment.
Yeah, it does seem like they have rightly, obviously, dominated a lot of attention. But in many ways... they're doing their job if they are not attracting much attention, and they are attracting the right attention. Mm-hmm. But we'd like to thank our patron for submitting this very timely question. And us here, you there, and we'll be back right after a word from one, Anna Domini.
Be sure to follow and subscribe for upcoming AD History podcast episodes, available wherever podcasts are found.